Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 2nd, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing criminal prosecution of large firms, financial firms in particular. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. Paul Atkins is Chief Executive of Potomac Global Partners, LLC, which provides consulting services regarding financial services industry matters, including regulatory compliance, risk and crisis management, public affairs, independent reviews, litigation support, and strategy. From July 2002 to August 2008, Mr. Atkins also served as a commissioner of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Tim Flanagan is a partner in the McGuire Woods Law Firm. He has 30 years' experience at the highest levels of private practice, government service, and in-house corporate representation, including serving in the White House as Deputy Assistant and Deputy Counsel to the President of the United States, and serving in the Department of Justice as Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. Prior to rejoining McGuire Woods, he served as Senior Vice President and Deputy General Counsel at Tyco International Limited and as General Counsel for Tyco's Safety Products Division. In that role, he was part of a small team of high-quality leaders brought in to rescue Tyco from the effects of the misdeeds of its former senior management. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them in turn, and then we'll take questions from our audience. And with that, Mr. Atkins, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be with everybody today. Today, our topic is to talk about too big to jail, whether or not some firms have grown too big so that the government feels inhibited to go after them for criminal liability. That's become quite a political football that's being tossed around lately, and it sounds like a very attractive or very troubling sort of principle to be talking about. But there's actually quite a long history here, and what I want to do is touch a little bit on that here at the beginning. This has been brought up here for public debate after a hearing on the Hill a couple of weeks ago, where the Attorney General Eric Holder was posed a question about why the government has not gone after banks in the wake of the financial crisis. And in response to one of the questions, Attorney General Holder said, quote, "I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if we do prosecute, if we do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy," unquote. And then he went further to say, "I think that is a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large." And he went further to say that the size has, quote, "an inhibiting influence on what the Justice Department does. It affects," quote, "our ability to bring resolutions that I think would be more appropriate," unquote. So in the financial services area, of course, confidence and public confidence is everything. That if an institution loses that public confidence, then, you know, bad things can happen to it, including collapse. And so we've seen, for example, when the Justice Department went after Arthur Andersen back about a dozen years ago, that when an indictment was brought against it, Andersen ultimately collapsed, basically because the clientele did not want to have an accounting firm that had been indicted. And so once clients leave and then partners of the firm leave, the entire economic situation of the firm is impossible to maintain, and it ultimately collapsed. It didn't do Arthur Andersen much good, but the Supreme Court ultimately found that there were no criminal sanctions that should have been brought against Andersen, or at least that the Justice Department had brought. And so by that time, of course, Anderson was pretty much out of business. But if you look back to these debates, this is at least in the securities context, the whole role and mission of the SEC and how it works with respect to the Justice Department has been a cause of debate now for probably 40 years or more. And we have to remember that the SEC does not have the authority to bring any criminal sanctions. And it's only the Department of Justice working with the SEC that has the authority to do that. But going all the way back even to, say, 1984, there were debates as to what the SEC's powers should be with respect to bringing sanctions against registered entities over which it had authority. And back in 1984, I was just going to quote a SEC staff report to the Senate Banking Committee that stated that, quote, the federal securities laws are presently viewed by the courts as remedial rather than punitive, and that the SEC's non-monetary remedies were effective in most cases in providing that remedial relief, and that the advantages of seeking increased civil penalties appear to be marginal. There was a debate at that time as to whether the SEC's power should be augmented, and that there was a fear by the staff that if increased penalties were given to the SEC, that that would change the character of the enforcement program from remedial to punitive. So that was back in 1984, and my, how things have changed. And in fact, if we fast forward to the Dodd-Frank Act, that has now given the SEC administrative law judges the authority to impose civil sanctions on both entities and employees of those entities, and not having the, so the SEC does not have to go any longer to the courts to get those sorts of penalties. So things have changed, and obviously there's more of a an emphasis now on the punitive nature of the authority rather than just on the remedial nature. So the shifting of at least the SEC from being a regulatory agency to more of a enforcement agency. One other point I should add with respect to at least securities types of firms and investment advisors is that the securities laws are laced with all sorts of disqualification provisions. And so especially the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 carries a disqualifier that if a firm or an advisor be indicted, much less convicted, that that indictment carries a disqualification. And so some attorneys general, for example, in the state of New York under the Martin Act, the attorney general has both a civil and a criminal opportunity to go against the financial services firms. The Martin Act is sort of a Securities Act equivalent to the federal securities laws in New York, and it's basically a very general fraud provision, so it's analogous to Section 10B on the federal side. But Attorney General Spitzer used the Martin Act very effectively against some firms back in the early years of his tenure, where just the mere threat of an indictment was enough to induce the firms to settle even on evidence that probably would not have carried the day in court, as was seen when the Attorney General then tried to go after individuals who refused to settle, and individuals basically were acquitted once the case went to trial. But with that, I thought I might turn it over to Tim so he could give you a point of view from the Department of Justice's perspective.
Sure. Thanks, Paul. Actually, my remarks are going to be less from the Department of Justice's perspective as they will be from the perspective of a really a bricks and mortar, mostly non-financial company facing this same type of problem. I'm not really qualified to speak to the area that is Paul's expertise, that is the too-big-to-fail issues surrounding financial services companies. Instead, I'm going to draw on my experiences at Tyco and try to shed some light on the nexus of issues that a company faces when it encounters this type of rough sailing, either through market movements or more likely through some kind of misconduct. I'd like to give you just sort of a brief reminder of the events surrounding Tyco. The backdrop to my story at Tyco are the events really applicable to Enron in sort of mid to late 2001, in which, you know, the time period in which that company imploded. About the same time, you had WorldCom also encountering its financial difficulties and ultimately its failure. And so Tyco arrived on the scene as basically the third company, Tyco or Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco, as you know, three companies who had been beset by scandal. In the case of Tyco, the scandal, although there were some accounting issues with the SEC, the scandal portion really focused on misdeeds by the company's leadership. The CEO, Dennis Kozlowski, the CFO, Schwartz, and the general counsel, Mark Belnick, although I'll add for all purposes that Mark Belnick was acquitted, whereas both Kozlowski and Schwartz were convicted. The irregularities that were alleged involved mainly taking unauthorized compensation. That was translated into looting, allegations of looting the company. You know, a good question as to whether or not, you know, why did Tyco survive when both Enron and WorldCom went under? Well, there are some important differences here, and I think they're instructive. And they center around is what makes a company too big or too valuable to fail. Tyco was a $38 billion company. It employed 250,000 people around the world, and it was a real business, delivering real products, generating real profits. At the time, Tyco's sort of headline business was the ADT Securities security services company, although it had many other real sort of bricks and mortar businesses that it could rely on. A few lessons learned from the experience at Tyco. Obviously, the company did not fail. It was not put out of business, although it was seriously in the crosshairs of a number of prosecutors. The prosecutorial baton for Tyco was really passed by all of the various sort of prosecutorial baying wolves that were after Tyco at the time to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. But a few lessons that we learned in that process that I'll share just briefly. The first one is to try to find the white hat and put it on. In any sort of situation in which wrongdoing is alleged, organizational wrongdoing is alleged, there's going to be an opportunity to seize the high ground and to try to take a position that's going to make you look like the good guy in the room. At Tyco, both the CEO, the CFO, and the general counsel were gone, and as part of the new management team in the company, we basically did everything we could to position ourselves. This, some of us referred to this as the "we're not the droids you're looking for" strategy, but being as different as we could be in form and substance from the previous management. Cooperate. It was essential to us to quickly gain the trust of the prosecutors we were dealing with at all levels, and to do that, we bent over backwards and really expended a lot of corporate time and treasure on making sure that the prosecutors were able to build the cases that they were building against those individuals that they chose to indict. In the course of this process, we did something that really I think had not been done before at any company, and that was because the old board of directors of Tyco was hopelessly tainted with the taint of having basically been asleep at the wheel and let these events take place, we persuaded the entire board of directors to step down and be replaced. and so which was done in late 2002, early 2003, and that gave us a huge bit of credibility and also a huge enhanced ability to say we're not really the ones you're looking for. The ones you're looking for are those guys over there, the ones that are on the outside of the company. Another lesson learned was I really go back to something that the justice that I clerked for, Chief Justice Berger, taught me. He said, if everything appears to be going well, you've obviously overlooked something. And sure enough, just when we thought we had we had all the prosecutors on our side, we had all the regulatory agencies on our side, even Paul's former colleagues at the SEC were beginning to view us as good actors in trying to overcome the few remaining accounting difficulties. Just when we thought everything was going well, we had a call out of the blue from someone who said that the GSA, otherwise known as the government's landlord, was considering debarring us from all government contracting. And although Tyco didn't do a great deal of government contracting, the amount of government contracting and government contract-dependent work that we were doing was significant, and it would have shut down the company had we been actually debarred. We mobilized quickly, you know, made a presentation to the GSA, and were able to convince them that you know, this was not a criminal enterprise company, which they had supposed. I think the an additional lesson is, you know, early, as early as possible in the process, bring in someone with the credibility of a Paul Atkins to do your investigation, to be your spokesman. In our case, the previous board had hired the Boies Schiller Law Firm, and David Boies, I have to say, did an excellent job representing the company and doing a very thorough global investigation of the company, which really sort of nailed down all of the issues that we had, and we were able to address them in sort of prompt and convincing fashion. It was very important that the senior management of the company changed, and as we progressed through our problems, we realized that some of the remaining managers, senior level managers at the company, business unit leaders, were also tainted by the earlier processes of the company, and in order to preserve the credibility of the company, we had to let them go as well. Today, Tyco has gone through several corporate reorganizations, but it is a very healthy and vibrant company, and I think has survived largely because we had good crisis communication management and we had good legal advice in that process. And with that, Dean, I think I'm supposed to turn it back over to you. Is that right?
That is correct. Thank you very much. Let's open the floor to questions from our audience. We've got quite a few people online. In a moment, you're going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have one question, and then our lines will be open. Before we go to that first question, let me make our routine announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We have one more call scheduled for the remainder of this week on Thursday. This is a very special Teleforum conference call when we'll be discussing the life and legacy of Judge Robert Bork. Joining us for that Teleforum call Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time will be Federalist Society founder and chairman of the board, Stephen Calabresi, and Judge Frank Easterbrook from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Again, that's this Thursday at 2 p.m. And then next week, we will host Teleforum conference calls on the use of science in rulemaking on Monday, on the public ownership of stock in law firms on Tuesday, and on the Pentagon, NSA, and cybersecurity on Friday. As always, the schedule is subject to change, so please consult the Federalist Society website for a complete calendar of upcoming events. With that, let's go to our first caller question. Before we do that, let me ask Paul Atkins if you have anything further you wanted to add to your opening remarks since you went first.
Oh no, I mean just to Tim's point there, the one thing, you know, corporations because of lots of things, you know, especially public corporations, have huge incentives to settle because they're trying to maintain their reputations. They're trying to keep their stock price up. They're trying to keep people on board rather than having them jump ship. And so there are huge incentives for them to settle. And I think that has definitely dawned on people in the prosecutorial and regulatory agencies, including the DOJ and the SEC, and that they know that, it definitely behooves them to bring in big heads on pikes with big numbers to boot, that then garners a lot of attention in the press, big headlines, which has both an effect, it has an effect on the program, so a programmatic effect to benefit the agency itself. It makes the agency look like it's doing something. And then it also has an effect, a personal effect, on the people who are involved in the case because they get to then put the reference on their personal resume, which helps when they then go to leave the agencies. And so the one, the deleterious aspect of this is that it then encourages people within these agencies to, which is referred to a number of times by folks inside, especially at the SEC, is to push the envelope, to try to come up with actions that are not necessarily traditional, what the agency might have viewed as the law being, you know, what its purpose and intent might be, to try to, plow new ground, as it were. So that's one of the dangers. And then, so you see that, I would point to the Goldman Sachs enforcement action by the SEC of a couple years ago, where they went after Goldman for the Abacus transaction. It was a mortgage-backed securities deal that only had two investors, both institutions, and neither of which were American institutions. They were both foreign. The SEC wrung out of the out of Goldman a settlement of about $500 million. They supposedly had been asking for twice that. And so now we still, and there were a lot of aspects to that case that were, let's just say, unusual. I don't necessarily have to get into them now. But it was more, I would say, a politicized enforcement action than anything else. And we'll see, the SEC is still going after an individual, and we'll see how that one ends up. But I think the real danger to the current situation is that there will be trumped-up actions that go after particular institutions just for the PR value.
What is the, if I could ask very quickly before we go to the audience, what is the stated rationale on the part of the government for indicting a business or an institution rather than culpable characters, culpable individuals? I think, Paul, if I hear you correctly, you're suggesting it's there's some public relations benefit, there's some sort of feather in the cap aspect to it from the prosecutor's perspective. Is there something more than that on the part of the prosecutors?
Well, just a quick differentiation. That Goldman case I was talking about was not a criminal case, it was a civil case. And so there was no indictment. Although some people in Congress were calling for an indictment in that or for other things in some reports that came out of the Senate and with respect to not just that issue but others. But I think the pressure is, it's mainly a political pressure, public relations type of pressure. The rationale for indicting a company would be the egregiousness of conduct. I mean, that's the difference basically between a civil and a criminal decision there as to how to go. The scienter, of course, enters into it, or should, and other aspects. But in my mind, it would be a very, very rare event indeed to try to bring a criminal action against the company. I mean, the thing would have to be so riddled with criminal activity and just really egregious conduct, sort of like a, like almost like a mafia-related enterprise, that maybe it would be appropriate to do a criminal action against an a corporation. But, you know, people break laws. People are the ones, you know, individuals are the ones, I think, against whom criminal action, if indicated, should be brought, not necessarily a group where you have innocent folks, like in the Arthur Andersen case, who lost their jobs, lost their savings, their retirement, and it was just, it cost a lot of pain for tens of thousands of people.
I'll just add to that, Dean, that, that from our perspective, you know, the idea, which was seriously debated at the time, whether or not Tyco would be indicted a la Arthur Andersen or Enron and put out of business, was ludicrous. I mean, the idea that you put 250,000 people out of work, or 249,998 people out of work for the evil deeds of two people, struck us as really silly. And ultimately, I think the prosecutors that were involved recognized that. There is a stated rationale for corporate criminal liability, and that is that the corporation, the entity, even its ultimate economic, ultimately the economic interests of the shareholders, are benefited supposedly by the corporate misconduct, and the as a result, the company is the one that should be punished. In our case, and I think in many cases, it's very easy to show that the ones that were benefited, the entity that was benefited was not the company, but rather it were the individuals who were involved feathering their own nests instead. Corporate criminal allegations of corporate criminal liability are really quite common, and we see that all the time, that companies are accused of one form of criminal wrongdoing or another, and indeed, the organizational sentencing guidelines provide a basic framework, since most of those issues never even approach trial, but the sentencing guidelines provide a basic framework for assessing those penalties and for developing a set of solutions to corporate wrongdoing.
Let's take a question from one of our audience members.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We've been discussing here a lot of behavior that is arguably misconduct, both by person in the private sector and the public sector. But perhaps the focus should be on reforms that would perhaps prevent these sorts of situations from ever occurring in the first place. Perhaps you could suggest that what some of those reforms would be, perhaps, for example, building on the bankruptcy power to dismantle very large organizations in an orderly way, in the course of which perhaps many of their key personnel would be discharged, leaving an array of smaller organizations that might actually be worth more than the parent organization before the breakup, so the shareholders wouldn't be harmed. But that would clear the way for the kind of reorganizations that would prevent these kinds of abuses from occurring either on the part of the private sector organization or the government trying to put a feather in their cap.
Who wants to respond to that, Paul Atkins or Tim Flanagan?
Paul,
go
ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, that's part of what is the discussion going on in Washington now with respect to the Dodd-Frank Act and the powers that were granted to the regulatory agencies, specifically the FDIC, when moving in to try to resolve a situation where a financial institution has gotten into trouble and is on the verge of collapse. So the FDIC and others, the Fed, have very substantial powers to go in and reorganize. And so part of the debate right now in Congress is, is that for the best? And should there be more reliance on the bankruptcy code than on, say, the FDIC, as some of its reports seem to suggest, that the FDIC might step in and then try to reorganize to keep an institution going and in operation rather than either shutting it down or splitting it off. And so I think that's that debate is joined now, and we'll see how that goes this year. Sorry, Tim, to interrupt.
No, that's fine. Just a few thoughts. First of all, I think that by and large, large regulatory solutions to this type of problem, a la Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, have not been tremendously successful in getting to the root of these issues. I was in the White House and present at the creation of Sarbanes-Oxley and witnessed sort of firsthand the both the sort of the motivation and the skepticism that was built around the solutions that were crafted in Sarbanes-Oxley, and then later at Tyco, I was co-responsible for implementing many of the Sarbanes-Oxley reforms, and I will say that they were very expensive, they were very extensive, and consumed a lot of corporate time, but whether they really amounted to a set of safeguards or not, I think that subsequent events are a clear indication that they did not. Similarly with Dodd-Frank, I think you can find you can easily point to the huge regulatory burden that Dodd-Frank, at least as we understand it to this point, is going to impose on both financial service companies and the rest of the economy. But I seriously doubt at the end of the day that for all the pages of regulation that will be written, that Dodd-Frank will in and of itself prevent either the next big round of failures or the whatever wrongdoing is the target of those reforms. I will say, though, that I'm intrigued by the questioner's approach, which seems to eschew both this sort of broad regulatory approach in favor of sort of a simple let it fail approach and basically managing the failure of a company in a different way. I will say that what wouldn't have applied in the situation of the company that I was dealing with, but I do believe that it has great merit to allow companies to go through a failure process as opposed to propping them up. And if that failure process could be structured in such a way that that those who were financially responsible or personally responsible for leading the institution down a path that led to failure were to bear employment consequences as a result of that, I think that would be certainly to the good.
I think there was also maybe a suggestion in the question that larger firms are more vulnerable to fraud. And I'm wondering if either of you know, beyond sort of the Willie Sutton statement that that's where the money is, beyond the fact that large firms have more assets, is it the case that smaller firms are less vulnerable to misconduct, or is it just the larger firms that we hear about that are so prominent?
Well, I think I'll take the first crack at that, Paul, if I could. I think that certainly larger companies will presumably have better controllership in place to avoid fraud, as well as a more robust compliance staff, both financial services specific compliance as well as more general legal compliance to deal with those issues. However, in the context of those larger companies, there will be always more greater opportunities for someone to see the occasion where they can use the system in a way to their particular advantage, or the system will simply fail and will have bigger consequences because it failed in a bigger context.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you know, we're dealing with human beings, and human beings, of course, have vices and virtues, and you know, we will always have bad things happen, and so that's why there's such an emphasis on internal controls. And so, with small gains, to your point, with smaller firms, you know, the virtue there is that there's a very you know, it's a very small structure, and the leadership of the firm, you know, for the better or for worse, will you know, lead it, and so we'll be very much attentive to how things are, you know, the control of money and other activities. So, but it, you know, it very much hangs then on how you know, how virtuous that leadership is, and how punctilious they are about following the law. And then as the company gets bigger, more people are involved, and so, of course, then the infrastructure needs to grow with that. Sometimes a company will invest in that, and other times the company will not, and there are all sorts of different stories, you know, I could tell about you know, companies on both sides of that, how it can come to woe, or you know, they might skate by. A lot of it depends on the tone from the top, of course, from the top management. But as we've seen in Foreign Corrupt Practices Act prosecutions and other things like that, once a company gets bigger and bigger and then has all sorts of different cultures and countries in which it operates and has to deal with, you know, it becomes very much more dangerous, and a lot more emphasis has to be put onto internal controls for the compliance folks, for external auditors, for internal auditors, and all of that. So, of course, there's always a balance that you can, you know, pay incredible amounts of money to have, you know, the best internal control system, but the point of failure is always there, that there are people who are not so virtuous who will try to find their way around the best laid plans. So that's why these particular enterprises and organizations have to be very dynamic to try to stay ahead of the folks who will want to break the law.
We're speaking with Paul Atkins and Tim Flanagan. We're taking audience questions at this point. If you have a question for either, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one caller question pending. Oops, that caller just pushed their button. Oh, we do have one caller question pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Mar with this is Warren Belmar with a question, if I might. We're talking about two aspects of the criminal law application to too big to fail. One of it, of course, is punishment. But putting that aside and focusing on the deterrent side of the criminal laws, which apply in the antitrust area regularly to corporate misconduct and have effect. Tim mentioned the debarment problem as something that Tyco had to wrestle with at the end. We've had some very disturbing instances of financial institution misconduct involving most recently LIBOR, and we've had other things with money laundering problems with Cuba and Iran that have been the settlements of basis for deferred prosecutions. In any of those financial institution cases involving our largest financial institutions, there doesn't seem to have been any debarment in terms of doing business with the Treasury. What kind of a message does that send to the corporate executives who are settling cases with $2 billion of corporate money in terms of making sure that the people responsible are no longer with the company, as was the case with Tyco, and avoiding the kinds of consequences that a corporate criminal conviction could have, which is a death knell for a financial institution. Has there been any debarment activity with any of the financial institution companies that have admitted to egregious money laundering or LIBOR shenanigans?
Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I mean, I can take a first crack at it there. The LIBOR situation is very complicated. You know, I don't know all the facts there, but reading from the newspapers, there was a certain amount of government involvement as far as encouraging the banks to bid and to bid aggressively, as one of the emails that was publicized basically said. So, you know, it's on that one, it's kind of difficult to say. With respect to other sorts of SEC enforcement actions, I mean, the SEC does have the authority to suspend different registered entities from, carrying on activities in the securities field. And the one that I alluded to before was the Investment Advisors Act that the SEC has the authority to even give waivers to companies that have had enforcement actions taken against them so that they can continue to act as an investment advisor. Again, the rationale of not slamming a company with some of those particular remedies is that that would basically put a lot of folks who are trying to do the right thing in the company out of a job. If, a large broker-dealer investment advisor were prevented from offering investment advisory activities, that would mean that the individuals who were registered reps of it or registered advisors would not be able to carry on their livelihood. And so, again, the company would probably not be able to function. So that's why the emphasis has been on, other sorts of injunctions and other penalties. And so, like you're alluding to, what is the deterrent factor from those things? You know, again, I'd argue that the main deterrent factor is for actions to be carried on against individuals, and that oftentimes is much harder to prove. The reason, and that's why a lot of the enforcement folks at the SEC and elsewhere don't necessarily like to do this, because it requires a lot more investment in time and to build a case and to gather evidence and going after people. And it's not just, it's not a hit and run, so to speak. You can't just go and then rely on settlement. Now, if a lot of these things that you're alluding to, we don't know what the evidence is, like in the LIBOR cases or whatever, if the evidence is not very strong, right now companies have a large incentive to settle just to get it behind them so that there's not the overhang on the stock price or anything else. And so there is, as you kind of alluded to there, there's an incentive to settle with other people's money. It's basically the shareholders' money that's being forked over, to the enforcement agencies, as part of the corporate penalty. And then in many cases, individuals will get off. And so that's been a recurrent problem, one that I really bemoaned when I was a commissioner. And so I think that, frankly, the time is best spent by these regulatory agencies to build their cases against individuals who, were not virtuous, who did not, who did break the law, and then to go after that rather than to try to extract penalties out of the corporation.
Well, the only way I think you're going to get the deterrent effect is to have the senior management of the corporation on board with the regulators to either ferret out wrongdoing or alternatively to punish individually the people who put the corporation in that scenario. I'm not trying to talk about a questionable case, but if you take a look at the deferred prosecution agreements that have been filed with the criminal cases that could have been brought but were not, and were part of the deferred prosecutions, you see admissions of conduct that just shrieks out for punishment, and yet we see no real corporate impact other than a fine and the agreement to hire more internal auditors to try to make sure they behave the next time. But we're now facing recidivism in increasing number of cases. And until we have some deterrence that makes corporate management more responsible so that the incentive is not just to settle, but to maintain the integrity of the corporate operations, we're never going to get anywhere in terms of eliminating the problem, especially if criminal prosecution of the corporation is not palatable. And I agree, it's not palatable. But if there is no consequence, this all flows from the SEC's decision years ago to and fighting Judge Rakoff on thought that companies ought to be required to admit or deny, rather than allowing every civil settlement to know that the worst thing you could do is pay money and get the SEC to not require you to admit or deny the wrongdoing, which is laid out in chapter and verse in the pleadings that you're consenting to. So you leave it to the individual investor to bring a lawsuit that the SEC says it's not competent or doesn't have the staff or resources to devote to what are becoming bigger and bigger and more major and more disheartening of factual situations.
Yeah, well, I mean, as to, you know, neither admitting nor denying, I mean, the interest of the agency there is, you know, in quicker settlement of these cases and to get its PR value and to move on. And from a corporation's point of view, if it needs to, if it's going to be admitting the particular conduct, then that puts it in jeopardy from these private lawsuits that you're alluding to, the that are brought by, trial bar and class action lawsuits. So that's why companies, if it ultimately came down to, do they have to admit it in order to get the SEC off its back, I think you would see a lot fewer settlements because companies then would, they just would look at their pocketbook and think, well, you know, if we're going to admit this, then, we're certainly going to get a huge class action then and have to settle. So we might as well just fight. And then the SEC would have to go to trial much more. It would have to build its, the good part about that is that it'd have to build a better case. A lot of times when you look at its complaints and the orders of the SEC when they're filed in court, you have to realize that's only one side talking. You don't necessarily have the benefit of the countervailing evidence from the other side. So once this gets placed before an impartial trier of fact, it might not come out the way the SEC or some of the other regulatory agencies want it to come out. So that's the debate that goes on. And in fact, it was interesting where Barney Frank, who was at the time, I believe, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, or maybe he had just the House had changed by then. But there was a hearing before that committee with respect to whether or not things ought to be, the SEC ought to, not go down the road of allowing people neither to admit nor deny. And so from what I understand that, Congressman Frank started out as being very much skeptical of that policy of the SEC, but by the end of it, by the end of the hearing, they had changed his mind. So I think it's a big consideration as to what the proper standard should be and regulatory philosophy. But I think if you do take away that neither admit nor deny rubric, it will make it much more difficult for the agency to settle cases in the end.
Tim Flanagan, did you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I'll just add one or two points. For, you know, the origin of the question related to debarment, and you know, debarment is a very difficult and tricky remedy both for the government and for the company involved. From the government's standpoint, of course, you know, debarment deprives the government of a supplier, so the government may the prosecutor may see it very much in his or her interest to get the additional bang of having a company that is doing business with the government precluded from doing business with the government, or I should say avoiding the criticism that could flow from the situation in which a wrongdoing company, a company that is harmed, that is the public in some way, is continues to make money by buying and selling, or by selling to the government. And yet the agencies that actually buy from that company, even if they were harmed in some respect in the company's wrongdoing, are going to think long and hard before they're going to want to see that supplier taken offline. From the company's standpoint, it's just a horrible scenario. I mean, the getting on that debarment list, even if only a small percentage of your sales flow to the government, can really be a death sentence for a company. And so a company is likely to do everything it can to avoid having that included in the actual list of remedies that are imposed at the end of the day.
Yeah, and to throw in a couple more points here that because I think this is a really important point about deterrence and how to make sure that things don't happen. So I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that these sorts of problems, when they arise, are just huge problems for corporate management and for the company as a whole. You know, the stock price gets hit. There's huge distraction internally. The investigation costs a lot of money. And so it's not as if companies, are trying to, skate on the edge constantly, ignoring potential problems, and then, figuring, well, the cost benefit, we'll just pay the price when this comes about. You know, people do lose jobs. There's lots of issues that come on. And so ultimately, of course, it's the shareholders that pay. But I think the, you have in corporations, you have folks who are trying to do the right thing. A lot of it comes down, again, from tone from the top. And that's where I think when we're talking about deterrence, for enforcement agencies to really hold the people at the top responsible for it, and then that will help then encourage how the whole infrastructure of the company will strive for being straight and on straight and narrow. And part of that also gets back to then predictability of what the law is. And too often, I think regulatory agencies and SEC has been guilty of this, who try to regulate through enforcement, who regulate through speechifying, and don't do the proper groundwork of actually laying out concretely what the rule is. And, maybe, in fact, as it plays out, maybe that might be one of the instances of that LIBOR case that was referred to earlier. Again, we don't know all the facts. We don't know how the government authorities were involved on both sides of the Atlantic, what was encouraged, what was not. I mean, certainly a lot of the conduct sounds really terrible, and so hopefully there'll be a report at some point that will explain some of that. But, a lot of times what we don't know, bears on the story here of it's not just what you read in the paper.
We've mentioned debarment a couple times, and it sounds like it can be a pretty blunt instrument and just as deadly to a company as a criminal indictment. I wonder if either of you, this might be on the scope of this call or might not be an easy question to answer quickly, could talk about the process involved there, the level of proof, and the recourse a company has once there's a threatened debarment. Does the company have much recourse?
Well, I know I'd be talking way outside my area of expertise by trying to describe levels of proof. I only know from the experience that I have with Tyco that it is a fairly easily invoked remedy, and that any one agency can put a company on the temporary debarment list. And
government-wide.
Government-wide, and it takes an awful lot of effort generally to get off that list. So it's not a process that involves. There is no due process involved in getting on the list in the first place. So, at least as an initial or temporary matter, and temporary here translates into at least a matter of months generally, which of course can be a fait accompli for the business. Now, I would just give by way of explanation that if a company is not selling the majority, even if you're not an aerospace company, for example, that's selling everything you make to the government for defense purposes, even if only a small portion of what you make is sold to the government, your customer base may well have considerations that some of its product is sold on to the government, in which case it will have as a very firm, very inflexible policy that it will not buy from any company that is on the debarment list. So, very easily a small portion of government sales can cascade into a huge problem for a company in that way. And companies have, several companies that I've been associated with have dealt with this issue by trying to get out ahead of these types of situations in which there's a possibility that a hearing officer or a contracting official may wake up one morning and feel badly about a company or angry at a company and put them on the list because of something they're reading in the newspaper. You don't want to under-communicate with your government clientele in situations like that. You want to be ahead of the curve.
That was Tim Flanagan. Paul Atkins, do you have anything on this final question?
Yeah, well, just with respect to the – I can only really speak to the independent regulatory agencies in the financial services area. So, of course, the banking agencies have huge discretion to take away a bank's charter or to even grant it additional authority if it wants to, say, merge or expand or whatnot. It's a very opaque system, to say the least. But they look at character of management and reputation of management. Directors, in fact, since the late 80s, early 90s, have been held personally liable to the full extent of their personal assets if they knew of things that were going wrong, red flags are there, and they didn't take steps to act on it. So on the banking side, there are huge potential remedies for the regulators to use. It's not government-wide, any kind of debarment, but they can definitely put companies out of business. On the securities and futures side, the SEC and CFTC also have a pretty broad authority to take away a license to practice both for individuals and for companies. There is a due process aspect there. Either you have to go through the federal court process or through the administrative law processes at the agencies. And then, as I mentioned before, with investment advisors, character plays a part, and they can an investment advisor can lose his license relatively easily.
Well, gentlemen, we have exhausted our budgeted time. I want to thank both Paul Atkins and Tim Flanagan for joining us today and for their thoughtful comments. I want to thank the audience as well for their contribution and for joining us today, and invite you as well to join us for our special tribute to Judge Robert Bork Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.